Well, today we've had to cancel Citywide, but I was excited about this teaching from Revelation this time. I've heard from many of you how you've been enjoying the teaching so far, and so I thought, why don't I record it and you can listen to it at home. If you listen to it today, this Sunday, in lieu of being together, that's great. If you listen to it another time, that's fine as well. And I think I'm going to try and make this into a video presentation as well, so that the kids can watch some of the slides and see and follow along. As you remember, we've been trying to incorporate some of our older kids into the opening part of the teaching. It's been going really well, and the kids have been enjoying it. So hopefully they can watch along or listen into this next part in this really wonderful book, the Book of Revelation. So today we're going to continue with the Book of Revelation, looking at these seven visions of Jesus, these seven times that John sees Jesus in the Book of Revelation. We looked in chapter 1 where the first vision of Jesus is, and today we're going to move into the second vision of Jesus, which is found in chapter 5. Except that when I started studying for this teaching this past week, what I discovered was that chapter 5 is actually a part of chapter 4. It's a continuation of a scene that begins in chapter 4. And so to understand or to get the full meaning of chapter 5, what that means is that we need actually chapter 4. We need the first part of the story or the first part of the scene in order to understand the second part of the scene. And so today in the teaching, we're going to start with chapter 4, and then next time we're together at St. Agnes, we'll move into chapter 5 and see the vision of Jesus itself. And I was thinking about this week as well, just a little reminder, a little refresher, that when we read the Book of Revelation, we don't want to read it so much like we're scientists, you know, with pocket protectors and pens in hand trying to figure out every little part and every little thing and how it connects. Instead, I think Revelation wants us to read it as like we're poets, where we ride along on the journey with John, seeing all of the visions and all the pictures that he sees and all of these things so that we can also understand the deeper things that Revelation is actually wanting to reveal to us as we read. So let's get into it. Chapter 4 actually begins with this really wonderful word. It starts with the word look. Actually, it starts with two looks. It says, after this I looked, and look. And that second look is like it's a command. It's saying, you have to do this. It's like he's saying, I looked, and well, you need to see what I just saw. Or I looked, and look at this. That kind of a thing. I think maybe the best way to explain that is, you know, when you're out on the beach and the tide has gone out, and what do you do as kids or even as adults as you're out in that, what they call the tide pools around the beaches, is what you want to do is you want to find all the rocks and flip over all the rocks, because what happens when you flip over the rocks? Well, you know, you flip it open and all of a sudden all of these creatures come scurrying out all sorts of different places, crabs and creepy crawlies of all sorts of different kinds. And they're just going scurrying everywhere to try and find a new place to hide and to be in the wet moisture underneath the rocks. But you, when you flip over the rock, that's exactly what you want. You want to see. And right away, what do? Well, you call for other people to come and look. It's like you look and then it's, hey, look at this. Look at what I just saw. Check this out. Hey, come over here. Look at this. And everybody gathers around to see what it is that you found in your little hidden world underneath the rocks. And I think that's kind of what's going on here with John. It's like, I looked, I flipped over the rock, I saw what was being revealed to me, and look, you need to see what I see. And as I've been trying to teach everybody so far, he wants us, John, the writer of this, the Apostle John, who's the pastor of these seven churches in Turkey, he wants us to know that though he's seeing these things and these really amazing visions, that what they're pointing to is really real. That just because they're being described in these visions and these incredible ways doesn't mean they're imaginary, just the opposite. It means that they're even more real. Even more real than, well, if we could put it that way, even more real than you and I are. They're really real. So what is it that he sees, right? What does he want us to see? Well, that's what we see next. It says, after this, I looked, and look. And what does he see? Is a door standing open into heaven. He looks, And then he wants us to see with him a door that's standing open to heaven. Which raises this really great question, doesn't it? What is heaven? The interesting thing about that question is that we actually don't know much about what heaven is, at least not from the Bible's perspective. We see a lot in the news, and we see a lot in movies, and we see a lot in television, and we see a lot in art, and all sorts of different depictions about heaven, but those are probably more imaginary, certainly, than they are what the Bible tells us. As I say, the Bible actually doesn't tell us a lot about heaven, but the one thing it's certain on is that heaven is God's home. Heaven is his realm. But what's different, and I think this is important for us to understand, is that while it's God's realm, it's not so much that it's out there, like in outer space somewhere, or way out there. That's more what Hollywood says that it is again, not so much the Bible. Actually, this might be interesting to you. The Bible depicts more the language of heaven being right here, right with you, right with me. Heaven is here. It's just that it's in another dimension. It's in another place of space. It's in another time dimension. It's more like heaven is here, but we can't see it. It's invisible. God, then, and his angels are present with us in their dimension, which encompasses all around us. We just can't so much see it. But in John's vision, he tells us that a door now was being opened so that he could go through that door and see more of what heaven was about. Now, if that's all a little confusing, this idea of heaven being here, right there, right with us, but in another dimension, maybe this will help you make a little more sense of it. Have you ever read, and I'm thinking especially of the kids right now, but the adults too, have you ever read or seen the book of series, or the book called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, written by C.S. Lewis? It's a wonderful book, and it's a part of a larger series called The Chronicles of Narnia. They've been making movies about it, so maybe you've seen the movie instead. But it's this amazing story where there are these four children, the Pevensey brothers and sisters. They are in London. It's during World War II, but they have to escape London. They're sent out of London because the Germans are dropping bombs on the city of London. So they have to escape out of London, and they're sent off to a country estate, to a large home that I think it's their aunt and uncle's home, and they there arrive in the country. And while there, what do? Well, they do what every kid's going to do when they arrive into a big home, right? They start looking around, and pretty soon the looking around turns into a game of hide and seek. And the youngest of these brothers and sisters, Lucy Pevensey, she scurries off on her own and finds this empty room. She heads into the room, and there in the room, well, it's not empty, actually. There's a wardrobe in that room. And the wardrobe, well, if you don't know what a wardrobe is, it's like a big closet, almost like a chest of drawers, except bigger. And it's the kind of thing where you can hang jackets and pants and skirts and that kind of stuff up into. And Lucy discovers or decides that this is going to be a perfect hiding place in her game. And so she climbs into the wardrobe. But what she doesn't know and is about to soon find out is that the wardrobe that she's into, well, it's actually a magical wardrobe. And the wardrobe serves like a door that leads her into another world. It leads her into another dimension. It's a door that leads her into this place called Narnia. Maybe we should watch a little clip of it if you're at home and you can see the clip if you're watching it on video. Well, first of all, here's a picture of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe for those of you that are watching this, the cover of it. And let's go on and watch the clip of Lucy. Thank you. See, in the scene we just watched, and in the whole story of the Chronicles of Narnia, which is something they call an allegory, C.S. Lewis, the writer, he's really trying to help us understand what heaven is about. The Chronicles of Narnia and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's like a picture. And he's saying that heaven is just like the Bible teaches, is right there, just through the wardrobe, like Narnia was through the wardrobe. God's dimension was just right there. It is right here. That God, in his heavenly throne, in his heavenly home, is all around us. God is present with us then in that way. Well, so what happens next? Well, what happens is that John, invited through the wardrobe door, invited into heaven, does just that. And he goes into heaven and sees in this vision. And what does he see? Well, the first thing, there's that word again, look. He says, look, a throne stood in heaven. That's the first thing that he sees. When he goes through the wardrobe, he sees a throne and one is seated on a throne. Well, what's a throne? Well, a throne, of course, is the place where kings and queens sit. It's a place of power and authority where the king and the queen rule from. In other words, what we see here is that John, the first glimpse that he has into heaven, into God's realm, and what does he see? He sees a ruler. He sees that someone is in charge. He sees that someone is seated on the throne. And when one is seated on the throne, it's there that they are ruling. It's there that they are taking a posture of power and of control from. And as the vision continues, we learn that the one that's on the throne is God. And as the pictures are given to us of what God looks like, we learn from these pictures and from these images that he is powerful and that he is wise, and all of the creatures gathered around him, they're all wearing crowns, but they're taking off their crowns in the vision and they're putting their crowns before him because they are seeing that this one that's seated on the throne, God, is so much greater than they are, that he is wise and beautiful and powerful in ways that they are not. Now here's the thing. In the last two teachings, especially for the kids, we've talked about how the people that are getting this letter are afraid. And you remember why? They're afraid, right? Because the rulers of the Roman Empire, these guys Nero and Domitian, have been hunting them down and throwing them to lions, and you'd be afraid too. And maybe the truth is, maybe you are afraid right now. Maybe there's things that you're fearful of in this world, things that are happening around you right now that are causing you to be afraid. But here's the lovely gift of the Bible and of the story of Revelation, is that when John looks into heaven, he sees the reason why none of us need to be afraid. And the reason is because in heaven, which is right here, there's one that is on the throne, and he is God, and he is powerful, and he is big, and he's in control. Regardless of even what things may look like, he's in control. Well, that's what I wanted to say, especially for the kids. And at this point, I was going to say, kids, you're welcome to go. But if you want to continue to listen in, you're welcome to, of course. But we're going to continue on with the rest of Revelation chapter 4. And as the vision continues, we see more of what it was that John saw when he looked on the throne. And perhaps in the next time together, we'll unpack more of what those things are. But as I was studying this week, I was particularly drawn and impressed that we needed to think about just what it talks about in verse 6. Because there in verse 6 of Revelation chapter 4, we read this. It says, "And before the throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass, like crystal." So as he sees into heaven and he sees the throne, in front of the throne now, what he sees is this crystal sea. It is a body of water, but it is flat like glass. And you've all seen that when you've been to the Okanagan or something like that, and you've seen just water, just clear, reflective. And usually it happens in the morning, and that's the best time to get out and water ski and wakeboard. You know what's being described here anyway. And the sea, especially for those of us living in Vancouver, which I assume is all of us unless you're listening in from some other place, the sea, well, here in Vancouver, we love the sea. I mean, we love the smell of it. We love the sound of it. We love the sight of the sea. We love being on the sea. Like the rushing water that I played last time and the sound of the river rushing over rocks. The sea has this ability here in Vancouver for us to just, it provides us with calm and provides us with peace. When we're feeling in a place of tumult, we can sit in front of the ocean at English Bay or looking over the Burrard Inlet down at the Ambleside or whatever. And it's amazing the power of calm that comes over us as we look out over the sea. Here's what we need to understand, though, when we're reading the scriptures, is that in John's day, and for John's audience, the sea was actually the exact opposite for them. These people, right, they were desert dwellers. And the sea was actually understood in their writings and in their talk, in their poetry, all those kind of things. The sea was actually the place of great terror. In their superstitions, the sea was the place of chaos. It was the place where ghosts and ghouls lived. It was where men went out to die as they got on their boats into the Mediterranean, were swept up into the storms, and they never returned again. The sea was the place of the Leviathan, the place of the monsters, all of these different kind of things. In fact, here's a great depiction, an art depiction of the sea as it was understood in that time. And you see this even in the Gospels. In many of the gospel scenes, it takes place around the Sea of Galilee, which is really actually more like a small lake in the northern part of Israel. But in almost every single scene that takes place on the Galilee, it's accompanied by storms and by terror and all that kind of, and even the sightings of ghosts. You remember when Jesus walks out on the water, what's the first thing that Peter calls out? It's a ghost, of course. I think I've talked about this before. A ghost, of course he thought it was a ghost. Because the water was the place where the ghosts and the ghouls lived. The sea wasn't like what we understand the sea to be. And in the rest of the book of Revelation, the sea lines up with this ancient Near East understanding. Daryl Johnson, he writes the following, this pastor that we've been referencing a few different times throughout this teaching. He says, from the rest of the book of Revelation, we discover that for John, the sea actually represents everything that opposes God. The sea represents all that seeks to overcome or to undo or to destroy the work of God. And as we learn then from Revelation chapter 13, it's from the sea that the first beast which rises up to oppose God emerges. It's from the sea that the first depiction of evil comes, in other words. He says the sea represents all that seeks to overcome and undo and destroy the work of God. Well, that's interesting. Because when we read in Revelation chapter 4, when John walks through the wardrobe, what's the first thing that he sees? He sees a sea that is not filled with chaos, but it is like crystal. It's like glass. You see what's being said? That before the throne of God, the sea has been subdued. Now, to a little church that's being hunted by the Roman Empire and terrified, no doubt feeling like they were these little boats being tossed about on this crazy, chaotic sea, you can imagine what this scene was saying to them. It was saying that in heaven, before the one on the throne, even the chaos and the evil of the world is rendered null and void. Now, why do I want to stay with that and just focus on that today? Well, there's a couple of things, two points of, I guess you could say, application that I think are important for us. And the first point of application, to understand it, we need to go back to Jesus' prayer. You remember in the Gospels how there was this one time where the disciples came to Jesus and they wanted to know how to pray. They had seen him praying and they wanted to know how they could pray like him. And Jesus says, well, the first thing he says is, okay, so when you pray, don't be like the Pharisees who, you know, want to make a big production of themselves and stand in public places and praying to look all religious and pious. He said, instead, go into a quiet place. And when you pray, he says, and here's the thing, start by praying like this. And he says this, Our Father, who is in heaven, there it is, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, do you see what Jesus is praying, what he's saying? In his prayer, he's telling us what it is that matters to him. And what matters to him, the first thing he wants us to intercede for, the first thing that he wants us to ask that God would do, the first thing is that the heavenly realm, what is true in the heavens, would become true in earth as well. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. A heavenly reality where chaos and evil is being and has been subdued. Lord, may it be so here too. He's asking us to pray that the vision that he sees and that is seen in heaven of a subdued evil would be true here too. And in the end, in Revelation 21, we see that the heart of Jesus is made true as heaven is seen unfolding here in the earth, and all things are being made new by Jesus. This picture of a sea subdued, this is what we are about as people. This is what we are about as people that are living as followers of Jesus in his kingdom, is that we are praying and we are joining in with Jesus in every effort to see that here in Vancouver and around the world, that the powers of chaos and evil that are subjugating people and ourselves would be brought low and subdued. And the second thing, to John's persecuted church, this scene really, it said one other major thing. And it said what I just said to the kids. It said, do not be afraid. Whatever it is that you face, whatever that you're afraid of, don't be afraid. Before the throne, the sea is as glass. The one on the throne has overcome. That was what the beginning in Revelation chapter 1 was saying. Fear, actually, is this reoccurring theme in Revelation. It comes up over and over again, which makes sense given the situation that they find themselves in. But the truth is that fear is also one of the most common themes throughout the Bible. We see fear spoken of over and 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 over again. But we see fear always attached to this other expression, and the expression is from the heavenlies, don't be afraid. And the scriptures want us to not be afraid, specifically because what it is that John sees in when he looks through the door, they want us to not be afraid because we have and can have confidence that regardless of what we see happening around us, like Nero or Domitian or whatever it may be in our time, there is one that is sitting on the throne. What are you afraid of? On Monday, I read something. It was totally other than what I was studying here. I hadn't even started to study yet. It was this book that I had randomly picked off the shelf because Jolie had been complaining that she didn't have anything to read. And it was this book by Henry Nouwen. And Henry Nouwen, for those of you that don't know, was an Harvard professor that toward the later part of his life decided that he was going to resign his post, this very prestigious position, and instead moved to Toronto in order to work at the L'Arche community with severely mentally and physically challenged people. He devoted the rest of his life to this cause. But he was also a prolific writer and a profound writer as well. Well, it was one of his books that I pulled off the shelf, and I opened the page, and the opening chapter was all about this topic of fear. And it occurred to me again that we're not done with this, that there's more about fear that Revelation is asking us to think about. Now, if we were to be all together, I was going to pass out copies of this so that you could take them home. And I don't know how this will translate onto the recording, but I want to read. It's fairly lengthy. I want to read anyways this passage from Henry Nouwen's, the opening portion of this book. And I'm sorry, actually, I don't even remember the name. Oh, the book is called Life Signs. And I want to read it all, and I think at the end it will make good sense to you. And I should say as well, this book was written in 1983, but some of what you're about to read will sound incredibly close to home. He writes, "We are fearful people. The more people I come to know and the more I come to know people, the more I've overwhelmed by the negative power of fear. It often seems that fear has invaded every part of our being to such a degree that we no longer know what life without fear would be like. There always seems to be something to fear, something within us or something around us, something close or something far away, something visible or invisible, something in ourselves or in others or in God. There never seems to be a totally fear-free moment. When we think, talk, act, or react, fear always seems to be there, an omnipresent force that we cannot shake off. Often fear has penetrated our inner selves so deeply that it controls, whether we are aware of it or not, most of our choices and decisions. The agenda of our world, the issues and items that fill the newspapers and newscasts, an agenda of fear and power. It is amazing, yes, frightening to see how easily that agenda becomes ours. The things and people we think about and worry about and reflect upon, prepare ourselves for, and spend time and energy on are in large part determined by a world which seduces us into accepting its fearful questions. Look at the many if questions we raise and think about yourself in this. What am I going to do if I do not find a spouse, a house, a job, a friend, a benefactor? What am I going to do if they fire me, if I get sick, if an accident happens, if I lose my friends, if my marriage does not work out, if a war breaks out? What if tomorrow the weather is bad, the buses are on strike, or an earthquake occurs? What if someone steals my money, breaks into my house, rapes my daughter, or kills me? Listen even to how the how questions work. How can I raise children in a world threatened by total destruction? How can I prevent another conflict, another war, or nuclear holocaust? How can I keep the Russians from coming too close? How can I succeed on my own as an adult? How can I keep my good name among my neighbors? How can I make it to heaven?" Though we think of ourselves as followers of Jesus, we are often seduced by these fearful questions the world presents to us. Without fully realizing it, we become anxious and nervous, worrying people caught in the questions of survival. Our own survival, the survival of our friends and families and colleagues, the survival of our church and our country and our world. Once these fearful survival questions become the guiding questions of our life, we tend to dismiss words spoken from the house of love as unrealistic, romantic, sentimental, pious, or just useless. When love is offered as an alternative to fear, we say, yeah, that sounds beautiful, but... And the but reveals how much we live in the grip of the world, a world which calls Christians naive and raises the quote-unquote realistic questions. Yeah, but what if you grow old and there's nobody to help you? Yes, but what if you lose your job and you have no money to take care of yourself and your family? Yes, but what if the refugees come to this country by the millions and disrupt the way we've been living for so long? Yes, but what about the Cubans and the Russians becoming so powerful in Central America and they start building their missiles in our own backyard? When we raise these again, quote-unquote, realistic questions, we echo a cynical spirit which says, "Words about peace and forgiveness and reconciliation and new life are wonderful, but the real issues cannot be ignored. They require that we do not allow others to play games with us, that we retaliate when we are offended, that we are always ready for war, and never let anyone take away the good life that we've so carefully built for ourselves." But as soon as these so-called real issues begin to dominate our lives, we are again right back in the house of fear. Even though we keep borrowing words of love and continue to experience vague desires to live in that house of love. But is it possible, in the midst of this fear-provoking world, to live in the house of love and listen there to the questions raised by the Lord of love? Or are we so accustomed to living in fear that we become afraid to the deaf voice, or we become deaf to the voice that says, "Do not be afraid"? This reassuring voice, which repeats over and over again, "Do not be afraid, have no fear," is the voice that we most need to hear. This voice was heard by Zechariah when Gabriel, the angel of the Lord, appeared to him in the temple and told his wife Elizabeth would bear a son. The voice was heard by Mary when the same angel entered her house in Nazareth and announced that she would conceive and bear a child and name him Child, or Jesus. This voice was also heard by the woman who came to roll away the stone. "Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid." The voice uttering these words sounds all through history as the voice of God's messengers, be they angels or be they saints. It's the voice that announces a whole new way of being, a being in the house of love, the house of the Lord. Why is there no reason to fear any longer? Jesus himself answers this question succinctly when he approaches his frightened disciples walking on the lake. It is I. See, there it is, the one on the throne. Do not be afraid. The house of love is the house of Christ, the place where we can think and speak and act in the way of God, not in the way of the fear-filled world. From this house, the voice of love keeps calling out, do not be afraid. Come and follow me. See where I live. Go out and preach the good news. The kingdom of God is close at hand. There are many rooms in my Father's house. Come, take your heritage for the kingdom prepared for you since the foundation of the world. The house of love is not simply a place in the afterlife, a place in heaven beyond this world. Jesus offers us this house right in the midst of our own anxious world. And I think that's exactly what I'm trying to express and how these two applications knit together. That heaven, this throne room of God, is present right here in this world. And that's the exact reason why we do not need to be afraid. Because whatever it may seem is happening around us, and whether you live or whether you die, whether you experience great riches or whether you experience great poverty, as so many in our present world are, the reality is that God is in control, is that he is overseeing a plan, not just for you and for now and for this breath, which is here today and gone tomorrow, but for all of eternity. And that plan says that evil will be subdued and that you can be at rest. And I think that's the word of the Lord for us today. The Lord be with you at home. Amen.